So, I'm asked, there's a common question that I've been asked over 30 plus years of leading high holiday sermons and services. People say, Bob, you've been doing this 30 some odd years. Don't you just like run to the drawer and just pull one of those old sermons out? I mean, you've given them in different places and some not everyone's always there. And frankly, people may not even remember what you said. So just do that. And I'm here to tell you, 30 plus years, I have never done that. I have been tempted more often than you might think to just grab one that I really liked, but I haven't done that. And it came out of a conversation I had when I was a student at the Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion. We were taking homiletics, sermon writing. There's actually a class on that. Go figure. Okay, so we had a class, and our professor, Dr. Sylvan Schwartzman, this conversation came up. Can you recycle a previously used sermon? It's like a previously owned diamond or a previously owned car. Can you reuse it? Can you sort of buff it up and make it look fresh and new? And Dr. Schwartzman said something that has stayed with me. I'm paraphrasing it a bit. It's been 37, 38 years. But he said, you can't really do that. You can't really do that because to go back and grab a sermon that you gave 5 years ago or 10 years ago, you're going to be talking about issues that existed 5 or 10 years ago. And you're going to be speaking as if you're 5 years or 10 years or 20 years or 25 years or 30 years younger than you are. A sermon that's old is out of sync with the present reality. And worse, a sermon that's old is out of sync with who you are as a growing, changing, evolving rabbi. To do such a sermon would be incorrect. His reason was about growth and change. And I'm here to tell you that Dr. Schwartzman was right. Growth and change are essential to an authentic rabbinate, and it is essential for an authentic Judaism. Well, this struck me more than ever this particular year, because I realized I've held a position for my entire rabbinate that needs to be changed. Evolution is not tangential to Jewish thought. It is core. And it's more than me just standing here talking about it. It means that I have to live it within my own rabbinate. So what I'm about to say, I wouldn't have said 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. It is a new position that I am about to talk about. And it comes out of a confluence of events that happened during the summer. As you might imagine, Rabbi Baum and I get together, and we sit down, and we start talking about the holidays. What are we going to talk about? That's a big conversation. What Torah portion? So we're already engaged in this conversation. And we get a phone call, and it comes to me. It's a wedding. Now, that's not a big deal. We get lots of phone calls about weddings at Congregation Beth Adam, from members and from non-members. And I was on the call, and the person said, do you officiate at interfaith weddings? And I said, yes. I've officiated at interfaith weddings since the beginning of my rabbinate. And the person said, well, do you co-officiate? Meaning, will you officiate the service with a non-Jewish clergy? It's an interfaith wedding, non-Jewish clergy. I don't know if it was a priest or a minister at this particular point. And I said, yes, I've held that position also for 30 plus years. I'm happy to do that. I've done that very successfully many, many times. And they said, well, oh, what about the Shabbat? Are you willing to do, it's a summer wedding, like 5 o'clock, because the reception needs to be at 6. So can you do it at 5 before the sun? I said, yeah, of course I can do it at 5 o'clock. That doesn't present a problem for me. And the person said, oh, great, this is wonderful. How about 2? I said, excuse me? They said, how about 2 o'clock on Saturday? And I went, I don't really do weddings at 2 o'clock on Saturday. It's the Shabbat. People don't get married. And the person, and I don't know if I've made this part up or it just really happened at this point. But the person said to me, well, you are willing to do it at 5 and the sun isn't down. So what's the problem with 2 and the sun not being down? And I hemmed and I hawed. They said 5 o'clock is sort of like evening. You know, it's evening sometimes, every once in a while. And I finally got off the phone. I had a conflict anyways, which was a lot fortunate at that particular point, but it did provide the moment for the sermon, which I'm thankful for. And I realized, I just didn't like my response. It was weak, it was inconsistent, and it bothered me, and it has continued to bother me. And I ran through all those justifications in my head that I used on the phone, and I have used for 30 plus years. I mean, that wasn't the first time I got that phone call. It just happened to be the most recent and this confluence of events. And I went through all the reasons I've given. It isn't done, okay? It's Shabbat. Like, I observe the Shabbat anyways. It'll upset other Jews. Like, I've never upset other Jews. And it's the principle of the matter. And I'm sitting there, and it going through my head, and Laura and I start talking. And I realized it was just bizarre. I couldn't figure out. I started trying to process this. What was going on? What was holding me? What had me trapped? Something I couldn't identify. I didn't recognize. And I began to realize I was being held captive by some unexamined or unknown assumption that was so ingrained in me, I didn't even see it in myself. It was influencing my decision-making, even though I couldn't pinpoint it. It was also at this time that I was doing research and preparing for this particular talk that I read a quote that was written 50 years ago, or spoken actually 50 years ago. And it wasn't a quote about religion, and it wasn't a quote by somebody who was Jewish or wasn't a rabbi. It was a quote from a politician. And that quote began to open up for me a window into understanding the problem I was having. I'm going to share with you the quote. It was John F. Kennedy, 50 years ago, Yale University. He was speaking about economics. This is what he said. "The great enemy of truth is very often not the lie, deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but the myth, persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic. The myth, persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic. Too often, we hold fast the cliches of our forebears. We subject all facts to a prefabricated set of interpretations. We enjoy the comfort of opinion, without the discomfort of thought. Mythology distracts us everywhere," Kennedy continued, "in government, as in business, in politics, as politics and economics, in foreign affairs, as in domestic affairs." And I think it would have been appropriate for him to have in religion as well. It was through that quote that I, as a progressive rabbi, began to see the problem that I was facing. Even though I have challenged many myths and many assumptions in my day, there was a myth that was holding me back. And before we go further, I want to be clear at this juncture that we all understand the term myth in this particular setting, how Kennedy used it, how I understand it in the term mythology. Don't think of a myth as a story or a legend right now. For this purpose, myth is much larger. It's more like a framework or a perspective through which we view and understand the world. Myth for this moment is like rose-colored glasses with blinders on. Rose-colored glasses with blinders on. Not only does a myth color and shape what we see, it also limits what we see. It is a powerful force, myth, that can keep us locked in the past, trapped in narrow confines, repeating what we've done with no easy way out. There's not one myth. That's not what I mean. There are many myths. But it's more like, think of it as an archetype. Think of myth now as an archetype, a category. And it's defined by certain elements, this notion. Myth is typically a framework that's handed down from generation to generation. It's supposed to be accepted without question. Evidence isn't necessary. In fact, if evidence is presented which contradicts the myth, what wins? The myth. The myth must be supported even when it flies in the face of common sense. And if there is dissidence, if there's a sense of internal conflict, we rationalize that away, inclining to the myth in order that the myth sustained. Do you do weddings at 2 o'clock? The myth. Nope, there's dissidence, and I worked it away. And the power of myth is how it comes to shape our thinking and our experience of the world around us. The myth becomes a lens with which we see the world. It filters out anything that we don't want to see. It makes the myth almost self-sustaining. And those who challenge the myth? Heretic, traitor, fifth column. It even has the ability to make us feel differently about our own selves. It is so deep, when we bump up against it, there is dissidence, doubt, inauthenticity. And while I'm primarily focused on Jewish myth today, be clear, this structure, like Kennedy said, affects all aspects of our lives. If you want, this is a fascinating thing to begin to explore in personal life. What myths we hold, whether it's political, social, it runs the gamut. But today it's about the Jewish myth, how it shapes us, how it influences us, and informs how we involved with Judaism. And one of the things that I've struggled with is, here I am, this liberal rabbi, I know Jewish history, how is it the myth is so strong still? How does it affect my decision-making? And I came across a very interesting article about science. Science. What scientific literature is now revealing about learning science is that when we learn a new scientific concept, the old concept still lingers in the background of our mind. So let me give you two examples. Even though we all know the earth revolves around the sun, in the back of our minds, if I ask you that quickly, you'll stop and pause. Like when I ask you, if two balls drop from a large height, a large ball and a small ball, which one hits the ground first? And even if you've all taken physics, which you, right? This is a very bright ground, all of this, I know. You all know the answer. They hit the ground at the same time. But for a moment, we pause and we have to think through. The old misconception is still in the back of our mind. It doesn't get replaced by the new one. It lingers, and we work through it. So Jonah Lehrer, who was writing about this, said, "We never fully unlearn our mistaken intuitions about the world. We just learn to ignore them." We never fully unlearn our mistaken intuitions about the world. We just learn to ignore them. This, I would argue, is very much the same tension we have with myth. Even when we come to recognize the myth is incorrect, that it's no longer reflective of reality, it still lingers in the recesses of our mind. It still has the power to influence our thinking even when we don't recognize it. It has the power to affect how we feel about ourselves. When we go against the myth, we're going against the past. We're going against our parents, our grandparents, our ancestors. We're going against those who taught us the myth. We're going against the myth that we were steeped in. We feel inauthentic. We feel bad. It's more than just about right and wrong at this point. It's about connections with past. It's about what lingers in the recesses of our memories. The more I began to consider this issue of myth and how it shapes my thinking and how it shapes the thinking of others, I began to realize that when I enter into conversations about Judaism on a regular basis within the Jewish community, whether nationally or internationally, about what's going on, the myth about Judaism is so strong, it is overwhelming, and it is not articulated. People don't acknowledge the myths that are shaping our Jewish community today, and there are three that are incredibly powerful that I want to expose today. The first myth is that there is an historic, authentic way to be Jewish, and that all modern expressions of Judaism are a variant of that core. That there's an authentic, historical way to be Jewish, and everything is a variant of that. That is a myth. We'll look at it. A second myth is that Orthodox Judaism, even for those who reject Orthodox Judaism, is the closest expression of that original, authentic form of Judaism. That's a myth. And the third myth is that the Jewish future will be found in the past. That Jewish survival will only result if we can find a way to get folks to embrace that mythic view of Judaism and to begin to express their Jewish identity through that set of lenses. These are unspoken myths that are influencing the thinking, they're influencing the conversation, they're determining what things, what programs are promoted, what programs are funded, what a community does, and more importantly, how it determines a direction for its future. We need to understand the myths. We need to expose them. We, as a Jewish people, we didn't begin as a religion. We are a people. That's what the whole Torah portion was about. It wasn't about religion. It was about lineage. It was about community. Judah, the tribe of Judah, the land of Judah, Judeans. It was only later that we began to have religious expression. But we are a people and we remain a people. The state of Israel, Zionism, is about peoplehood. And the other myth that you need to expose is that there is no single religious Judaism. As Judaism began to create religious thinking, it had lots of competition. There was internal competition. Different rabbis argued with each other about what was and was not authentically Jewish. Rabbis burned each other's books. There is no one Jewish core. And Orthodox as we know it today, whether we call it modern Orthodoxy or ultra-Orthodoxy, this is not a more authentic way to be Jewish. It may speak to some, but it is not an authentic representation of some mythic Judaism that used to exist. And when I see non-Orthodox movements trying to replicate the mythic image of the past, I know the Jewish future is in jeopardy. And while a small segment, the Orthodox community is a small segment. Everyone knows that. We've sort of lost. That's the new myth. It's the biggest. It's a very small segment funded by the non-Orthodox world. Funded by the non-Orthodox world in America and in Israel. We don't like to say, no rabbis like to say that aloud, certainly on the high holidays. But there's now people who are saying that is going to be the future of Judaism. I have heard it more than once that people are predicting that Orthodoxy is the future of Judaism and it's the only form of Judaism that will survive. And I have to say that will become a more isolated, insular Judaism. It's not a Judaism I want for my kids or my grandkids or the kids I teach here. It isn't the only authentic. If it speaks to some, that's fine. But it doesn't need to speak to all of us, and we do not need to feel into authentic because it is not our Judaism. When I go to meetings, and Rabbi Baum goes to meetings, whether it's local or national or international, we hear this infatuation with the myth. It keeps on coming up, and we raise new ideas, challenge the myth. There's skepticism, doubt, that there is. The myth is so strong. People don't like when somebody raises a question. It holds us tight in the present and in the future. It shapes how we make our determinations. It ties our hands and it blinds our eyes. But lest I'm too hard on those trapped by the myth, I have to say it happened to me. It happened to me. I fell prey to the myth myself. Not officiating at weddings on Shabbat was not a logical position. It was shaped by a myth that I held in my head somewhere. The Jews don't marry on Shabbat, which is foolish because I got a phone call from someone who was Jewish. You want to get married on the Shabbat. Of course Jews get married on the Shabbat. People are doing it all the time. And of course, most of us, the majority of the Jewish population, no longer finds those historic rules written by our ancestors in a different world when levirate marriage ruled. We're not bound by them. We may choose, pick and choose which ones we like, but that's choice, not obligation. And while I've come to acknowledge this reality in most of my personal life and even in my professional life, this inconsistency remained, this dissidence remained, this sense of doubt remained. It was fueled by myth that there's some right way to be Jewish. And I was falling into it. And it was some right way to be Jewish, scripted by people with whom I disagree. People who thought the world was flat, people who thought the earth was the center of the universe, people who didn't have the number zero, and I fell into the myth. That's how strong it is. It's hard. It is hard not to be influenced by the myth. It happens. It can happen to all of us. And what helped me to see through the blinders that I was wearing, those rose-colored glasses, maybe they're blue, we're Jewish, blue. Okay, blue-colored glasses with filters on, okay. Should have done that before. Why didn't anyone correct me? Okay, blue-colored glasses that filter the way we see was being part of a Jewish community that is progressive and liberal and evidence-based. We are an evidence-based historic Judaism. That's what we are about. Being part of Beth Adam or our Jewish community.org is all about having a community of people around us who support us, who help us give voice to this reality-based Judaism. I didn't grow up in this congregation. I grew up in a conservative shul. For those of you who don't know, I wanted to be a conservative rabbi. That was my original goal. I was steeped in the myth. I was steeped in the myth, grew up with it, and it came to affect how I saw the world, even as I began to progress in my thinking with great faculty at the Hebrew Union College and great philosophers of other books that I read. I began to peel that back, but the myth was still there. It is so deep. It's like trying to take a stain out. If you don't know it's there, you've missed it. Here at ourjewishcommunity.org and at Beth Adam, when we teach from a historic, evidence-based perspective. We acknowledge that Jews over time have changed, evolved, rejected different perspectives, embraced new practices. When we teach Torah differently. It's not just because it's more fun. It's important to understand what it is. It's legends, it's stories, it's literature. It was written by our ancestors with a purpose. Our goal when we educate children or adults is to have them confident Jews, authentic Jews who know who they are, raised and steeped in a Judaism that celebrates modernity and is not afraid of it. Having another rabbi that I could sit down with Rabbi Baum and really process this was really important. She challenged my thinking, and I hope that's what we do for you. That we have a role to play to help you see the myths that might be holding you even when you don't recognize it. Here we give expression to a Judaism that is not afraid to grow, not afraid to change. A Judaism, when informed by new information, is able to respond, not out of fear, not out of defensiveness, but not trying to keep the myth alive. But a Jewish experience that's energized and valuable and vital and vibrant. We may stumble. I did. But with caring people and like-minded people at our sites, we can move forward. So I reconsidered my position about doing weddings on Saturday, and I will do them. Now, wait, time out. But don't start calling. Because just because I do them doesn't mean I'm like available every Saturday. But I will do them. But more importantly, it's more than just the Shabbat wedding, the Saturday at 2 o'clock. It really has been about that experience for me, about challenges that we face. And I recognize how important we are as a community. We are a voice of reason in a conversation that is dominated by myth. We are a voice of evidence, historical reality, in a conversation that is dominated by myth. And if we're willing to do our job, if we're willing to hold that up, we can help move the Jewish community and the Jewish people forward in a direction it needs to be. A Judaism that's being shaped by myth will be insular, and it will be out of date, and it will appeal to the smallest segment of our people. And if we want to have a Jewish future, we have to help peel that back. So it's with confidence and commitment to a dynamic Jewish future that we give voice to a Judaism that accepts change, appreciates evolution, recognizes that the past isn't our future. Dr. Schwartzman said, "You can't repeat the sermons of the past from year to year." I say we can't simply repeat Judaism from one generation to the next. It is inauthentic and it is out of sync with reality. Growth is healthy. Growth is essential. New insights are a blessing, not a curse. And our people's tomorrow depends on those who are willing to embrace an evolving, growing Jewish experience.